Today's program was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com, the official page for travel to the Napa Valley, America's legendary wine, food, arts, and wellness capital. For more information, visit www.visitnapavalley.com.
This is Mitchell Davis, host of Taste Matters. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
You're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Lady Sue. When not on the air, my job is to eat and drink and connect people. No, I'm not eating people. I just realized my grammatical error there is something I say all the time. I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear here and working with my clients, which include chefs, sommeliers, big brand startups, those doing what's most innovative and delicious. First off, at the Green Market last week, we caught up with Gabe Kennedy, champion of this season of The Taste on ABC. We'll talk a carrot dish he cooked up for a season finale soiree he hosted at Marcus Samuelson's Ginny's Supper Club last week, plus a childhood memory and intimacy. Then in a few minutes, live in the studio, we will welcome Floyd Cardoz, formerly exec chef of North End Grill and the New York Times 3-star tabla, and now helming his very own, the brand new Tribeca spot, White Street. He's also chef advised the film 100 Acre Journey, you may not know that, and is known for pioneering Indian flavors alongside Western technique. So, we're going to talk Indian food. Why isn't it super cool yet? Plus, his kid, his causes, and his new restaurant about to open in India. Stay to the end, because to wind it down, I get with sommelier Carrie Strong of the Charlie Palmer Midtown New York restaurant Ariel to nerd out about not just wine, but wine events. What's working today? Let's go to the Green Market. Union Square Green Market with Gabe Kennedy.
Yeah,
a finalist on The Taste. So you're cooking up a multi-colored carrot dish.
Oh yeah, so yeah, definitely one of the dishes is going to be a carrot tasting with the plum.
Is it actually going to be multicolored?
It'll be multicolored.
Great.
There's
okay.
Lots of varieties of carrots. I think we're going to explore them all, but it'll be beautiful. You know, sort of obviously a tasting, quote unquote, right? Sort of in honor of the show. But for me, this dish makes a lot of sense as well because, you know, looking back on where my culinary career started, I can kind of pinpoint it back to one experience in the kitchen at age 2.
Really?
That's what the photos tell me. of cutting carrots for my dad when he was coming home from work. So I cut the carrots with my mom for my dad and put them on a plate. And that was it. So it's kind of funny how...
that is the original taste.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of funny how things come full circle in a sense that started my journey at a really young age. And now sort of the culmination of this amazing experience, which is, you know, being on a national television show cooking for Anthony Bourdain, Nigella Lawson, Marcus Samuelson, Chef Ludo, and a variety of other amazing chefs like Repair and Naomi Pomeroy and Andy Ricker.
What was your mom doing letting you cut carrots? Those
aren't
the easiest things to cut.
She should have been letting me cut the butter.
You were using like a real knife.
I must have been, or a sharp butter knife. I don't really know. I guess there was a lot of trust in the household.
Speaking of Andy Ricker, you had a fun challenge last week.
Yeah, last week's challenge was Bring the Heat, and I know it was an amazing exploration in sort of understanding the different layers of a seemingly, you know, normal ingredient, like the chili, right?
There's more than meets the eye.
Exactly, just like people. I think that, you know, it was an amazing, when I like to look at food sort of in this heart, it's like a symphony, you know, and you need to be building layers and flavor and texture and excitement on a variety of levels. You know, you have that base, and I'll just apply this to chilies, right? You have the, you know, that base, the baritone. Right, so the dish was this chili roasted, chili braised pork. On top of that was this this piece of crispy and very spicy prawn. And that was on top of a bed of kimchi puree, a little chili and miso roasted pineapple, and a fresh little salad of cucumber and daikon that also had some spice in it as well. And I think, you know, the exploration of building heat was really interesting. How do you build it on a whole bunch of different layers? So how do you have that base of the symphony that comes through as the slow burn, right? Those are those dried chilies that are in your braise, right? And then those medium chilies, which maybe, you know, you're marinating the shrimp in with some garlic and lemongrass and other aromatics, and then that fresh pop, which is maybe the pickled chili or that fresh chili. And so how are you taking,
somewhere.
the little green peppercorns the little landmines of peppercorns, right?
Right. It's amazing. So then the dish on Thursday where you're going to be doing a lot of flavors and levels with carrots.
Yeah. So it runs parallel, right? I think the takeaway for this heat dish is how do you build a variety of flavor, texture, in this particular instance, heat from a few seemingly just spicy ingredients, right? There's a lot of different flavors you can coax out of a chili, and the same goes for a carrot, right? So, you know, this carrot dish I'm really excited about because we're going to have this slow roasted carrot in the jacket, right? So we're not even going to peel it. We're just going to rub it with these beautiful spices, slow roast it so it becomes super sweet. It becomes meaty. You know, it's going to be over this velvety carrot puree, which is sort of the essence of carrot. Some pickled carrot in there, a beautiful pea stew from the carrot tops. What can you do with one ingredient? And I think it's interesting to explore this concept not only with carrots, but with beets or with sunchokes or with squash, right? How can you take this one ingredient and play with it in a variety of ways to create something that's really unique and beautiful and exciting? Right, so the thumbelina carrot versus the horse carrot.
Yeah,
the thumbelina, like the sweetest carrot. The horse carrot, this
so cute.
The huge, adorable little munchkin carrots. Like they're fucking awesome.
Horse carrot sounds exactly like what it sounds like.
Right, and juxtaposed with this like massive horse carrot, you know, that's been sitting underground for God knows how much longer than the thumbelina carrot, right? And so it develops all these different, you know, characteristics and attributes. And so
we need to do a carrot blind tasting. That's what
we should do. A carrot blind tasting, you know. That would be interesting, right? We'll get the Psalms involved.
So your mantra, Gabe, is...
Oh man, my mantra,
is about the intimacy of food.
Yeah, it is. Look, at the end of the day, food is a very intimate thing. And I think that, you know, let your food turn you on, right? Don't put something in your mouth if it doesn't turn you on. Because
talking about carrots.
And we're talking about carrots. Don't put a carrot in your mouth if it doesn't turn you on. I mean, like, there's only so many places that you can put things in or out of your body. And, you know, food goes in and out of, you know, two or three of those places. So it's like, it's a
your
really...
Your ears, obviously.
Right, exactly. I'm putting thumbelina carrots in my ears regularly.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue on Heritage Radio Network. If you love what you hear, do connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. That's at Leyte Sue, LEITIHSU, at Heritage_radio, hashtag WOMSHOW, WOMSHOW. And with that, I am so pleased to welcome hashtag people we like.
We like
Chef Floyd Cardoz. Welcome, Chef Floyd.
Thank you, lady.
So, you know, I've got to call this out because you don't seem that embarrassed about it, and you shouldn't be, but it's pretty hilarious. Like, this is like your sixth time in Brooklyn in your life in total?
Sixth, maybe seventh.
Okay, all right. And two of the seven are to come to Roberto's Pizza for a Heritage Radio interview.
Exactly, yeah.
So we're very important.
I love this show. I love this network. It's it talks about very interesting things and food, and all the hosts are great.
And I think we get to really get to know you, like take a moment to hear directly from you instead of paraphrasing and quoting.
Yep. I heard you're a pretty good interviewer.
This is going to be really painless because we're going to mostly talk about what I'm really curious about is your new restaurant in Bombay.
Yeah, so it's been my dream ever since I left India 27 years ago when I first started cooking, to open a restaurant in India, and specifically Bombay. And when I opened North End Grill, I hired this young Indian kid from Cornell, whose name is Samir. And when I was interviewing him, he wanted to come and work for us. And when I was interviewing him, I told him, I said, Samir, what are you doing here? You got to go back to India. I said, you got to go back to India, open a restaurant in India, because that's a huge market. It's waiting for good restaurants.
Huge, like way bigger than...
It's like a billion people.
Yeah.
A big middle class. And people enjoy food, and food is very important in India. And he went back a year and a half ago. We started talking. And my restaurant, the Bombay Canteen, is opening up next week.
Bombay Canteen. Does Samir have a Twitter?
Yeah, it's Samir Seth.
How do you Samir,
Samir Seth.
We're going to follow him.
Please do.
Yeah. Oh, wow, that's such a rad opportunity for him to come to the U.S., find you, and then be able to go back with such an opportunity.
Yeah, I'm so excited about it because I'm doing something that I want to do.
Yeah.
And doing something that most restaurants in Bombay try to ape and imitate the West.
Mm-hmm.
So the menus are, you know, burgers and pizzas and pasta. And very few modern restaurants celebrate Indian flavors, Indian ingredients, Indian foods. So we're hoping to do that.
So what is going to be on the menu?
I'm not at liberty to speak just yet.
Okay.
But the menu is going to be looking for the ingredients that people are forgetting in India, looking for the techniques that people are forgetting in India, making Indian food and Indian flavors more accessible. Right now, the younger generation in India believe that Indian food is for their parents. They all go to Western-style restaurants. So much so that these recipes, these ingredients are getting forgotten. You know, you'll see asparagus on a menu, which is not native to India. You'll see squashes that are not Indian squashes. You never see the wonderful greens. There's a plethora of greens in India. Nobody uses them. You don't see the street cart food done a little better in restaurants. You do see restaurants that are very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
We want to make this approachable.
So is this a Michelin-aimed restaurant or not?
Michelin's a tire company.
Yes.
They should make tires.
Okay. Understood. Now, if I as Leyti, a food-loving Westerner with some income to spend on food, because that's all that I spend on, if I go to Bombay right now, what am I looking at? Like, what's my itinerary without your restaurant in the picture?
There is, if you want to eat Indian food,
mm-hmm.
There is a lot of very, very good, inexpensive Indian food in Bombay. The regional cuisines are the best, and that's what you should go and eat at. You don't want to go to Bombay to eat at Morimoto. The sushi in New York that Morimoto serves is 100 times better.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you go to Bombay to do that?
Mm-hmm.
You want to go and eat stuff that is from there. The fish curries, the grilled meats, the biryanis, you know, the smaller restaurants, the not fancy restaurants, because they do food which is really, really good. And you get these flavors. You see fish. Like, I love mackerel. No fine dining restaurant does mackerel. But if you go to any of the small Konkan restaurants, they have mackerel, they have Bombay duck, they have all the bony fish. And they have a big menu, but if the fish is not available, they just don't put it on the menu.
Mm-hmm.
There are no imported fishes on their menu. It's all locally caught fish.
Right, because there's the Arabian Sea right next to Goa, which was a childhood vacation destination for you and your family, right?
Yep. Yeah, my family, I grew up in Bombay. But my grandparents lived in Goa, and we'd go there every year. And it's right on the coast, and it was colonized by the Portuguese. Hence, my name is a Western name.
Ah.
Because of the Portuguese. The food is very interesting because you have the Hindus, and you have the Catholics, and you have the Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
The Catholics eat pork and beef and use vinegar in their food. A lot of garlic, again, from the Portuguese. So there's a lot of adaptations of the Western cuisine from Portugal into Indian food, dried fish stews, like, you know, bacalao. You know, they make croquetas like the Portuguese do. So it's, but it's not like if you look at the at a croqueta from, say, Brazil and one from India, from Goa, they may look alike, they may have some connection, but the flavor profile is very different because it's been adapted to the Indian cuisine, so, to the Indian palate. So it's pretty interesting.
I have a parallel in my life happening, which is kind of uncanny. I'm doing a monthly pop-up, hashtag HSUSOUP, Sue Soup, Taiwanese beef noodle soup little thing. And I happen to have a new roommate who's currently studying at the CIA, and he's Lebanese, and he's just rad. His name is Eduardo Masi, and he's cooking at Cork Buzz right now, and we're just, like, doing this thing. And I just happen to find a young person who wants to play ball, you know?
You know, soups are very interesting. It's one of my favorite things to do, and over the years, people have always told me that I do soups very, very well.
Mm.
Like at White Street right now, I have a cauliflower soup. But I had one of my sous chefs, Jay Lee, we're talking one day, and he says, "Chef, do you know how to make aloo gobi?" Aloo gobi is cauliflower and potatoes. It's a very traditional Indian dish.
Oh.
And I was thinking soup that day, so I made an aloo gobi soup. It's got cauliflower and potatoes,
mm-hmm.
which is a very common Western soup to make, but it's got hints of spice in there, and it's got cashews in there, and it's got yogurt, which is very, again, it doesn't look or taste Indian, but it's got flavor. It's got a little bit of heat to it. I love using chilies as a flavoring sauce rather than hit you in the face, because you can build flavor with chilies and make things interesting and make things sing, and you want to know what it is, but you don't know what it is because you can't identify the heat source. It's a layer and a flavor profile.
It sounds like such a more diverse source of nutrients, too, this soup.
It is. And I think, you know, your idea of doing this soup pop-up is great because there are so many soups that you can make.
Right.
I mean, there's vegetables everywhere. There's, you know, lesser cuts of meat like oxtail soup.
You know? Oxtail is so underused. You know, I was surprised Whole Foods carries, like, woodier mushrooms and stuff,
but
no oxtail.
I went to look for oxtail in my Whole Foods, and I couldn't find it until I found one. And I cooked it last night, actually, for my son. I thought I was going to stay home yesterday because of the storm, which never happened. So I had this oxtail. And one thing which is great about oxtail is you can buy it frozen, too.
Okay.
It doesn't deteriorate.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing happens to it if you freeze it, if it's frozen under the guidelines. But I cooked the oxtail, and I cooked it in a pressure cooker. Again, most people don't know how to use a pressure cooker, but it cooked oxtail, which normally would take you 4 hours on the stove,
right,
in 25 minutes.
Oh, wow.
And then I used that and I made like a biryani. So I put black cardamom and green cardamom and mace, and these are all warming spices that you want to use when it's cold outside, and garlic and ginger, and I cooked lovely basmati rice with that.
That is so fantastic.
It was absolutely delicious, and I wish there were leftovers, but my son, my wife and myself, we just ate the whole damn thing.
I didn't bring you leftovers either.
Yeah.
what did your mom and dad do?
My dad was he was an artist. He used to work for an advertising company as a creative art director.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was a homemaker, so she, when we were growing up, she stayed at home. My dad, my mom, after we finished high school, she started working in a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my dad was always eating and drinking in the best dining establishments in the country, because that's what his job was, to entertain people. And
you guys got to go along?
No, not really. When I grew up, eating at restaurants was, India was not a big restaurant culture.
Okay.
So you would go to eat out Indian maybe once a month.
Mm-hmm.
Not Indian, go out to eat. And it would be a choice of either two cuisines. One would be Indian Chinese, and the other would be Mughalai, which is the Indian food that most people around the world know as Indian food.
Hmm.
You know, the chicken tikka masala, the kormas.
It's almost like English, Indian burgers and spaghetti.
It is. But you'd go out and eat it once a month. It wouldn't be an everyday thing.
Mm-hmm.
So when we did go out, we would choose Chinese, because we would have Goan Indian food at our home
mm-hmm.
almost every day. And you tend to eat your own cuisine a lot. So you wouldn't eat North Indian food or Western Indian food or Eastern Indian food or South Indian food at home. You would, if you were going like I was, you'd eat Goan food for lunch and dinner. Occasionally you might make one dish, or you may order a biryani. And I had not eaten a naan till I was 18 years old.
Wow.
You know, so it was not something I knew. It's changing now, you know, because there's less people have cooks at home. We had a cook growing up.
Mm-hmm.
So people are forced to go out and eat, or forced to go out and order food. So it's a little different now.
So the Goan tradition in your family comes from your grandparents?
My grandparents were Goan. My father and mother were Goan. Mm-hmm. They were both, my mom was born in Iran of Goan parents, but my dad was born in Goa.
So all of the impressions that we have of growing up in India and kind of come from the movies, one of which you advised actually. We'll talk about that in a second. So what was it like to grow up in India? It must be like totally different from the suburbs of California.
Growing up in India was actually pretty interesting. Most people don't, when they hear me speak, they say you speak English very well. I spoke only English growing up. I went to school in English. We were six kids. My dad, you know, we had a cook, we had maids, we had chauffeurs, we had gardeners. And the culture allowed for you to have those things. We woke up in the morning, our school uniforms were ironed and kept ready for us. Breakfast was at the table that we would go and eat and leave everything over there. Go change, shed our clothes, drop it on the floor, have the driver ready to take us to school. You know, come back home for lunch in the afternoon. Food was ready on the table. A hot cooked meal every afternoon. Mm. And, you know, it was different. Bombay, talking about the 60s and 70s when I grew up, was less populated. It was more a city of homes rather than apartment buildings, which it is now. It's very populated now. And it was very safe. You know, you had a lot of friends, and I had to be home at 8 o'clock every night, and I was home at 8 o'clock every night for dinner. And it was, you know, we'd play sports in school, cricket and hockey, field hockey and tennis, and you know, it was very, very different. But you would not get involved in food. It would not be thought right if you went into the kitchen to hang out with the cook or go to the market or, you know, go and buy stuff. You just didn't do it. It was more about the cook and the head of the home deciding on what the meal was going to be, and that's what it was, and you ate it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it was just something that you do not touch. Well, then at what point did you start to suspect that you're kind of an oddball when it comes to an Indian kid and you love the food?
I always love food. My mom always says that, you know, people eat to live, you live to eat.
Mm-hmm.
I always, always loved food. I'd go into the kitchen just to see if I could snag something to see what was for dinner for the next day. And people didn't even know. You know, my brothers and sisters didn't really care. They were fussy, but I wanted to know what I ate. And I had no idea that I was going to go into this profession. I went to undergrad in biochemistry. And I read a book when I was in college. It was called Hotel.
Read a book called Hotel.
Hotel, and it was about the hospitality world, and very, very fascinated by it.
Who wrote this book?
Arthur Haley.
Okay.
And I read the book, I was like, wow, I could do this. And by do this, I mean be the front of the house guy, the guy who throws a party, who welcomes everybody and cares for people. And so I got my mom's blessings, and I went into hospitality school. As part of hospitality school, I had to cook in the kitchen. Now, I used to cook at home omelets and such.
So your mom was kind of liberal. She wasn't like, don't touch that stuff.
Yeah. They would not stop us. You know, actually, my elder brother who lives here would say that I was a cook's son because I'd hang out in the kitchen. But I went in there and, you know, we'd go fishing when we were young, catch the fish, and we'd go steal potatoes from our kitchen and roast them in the fire and roast the fish and potatoes in the fire. Do very, you know, very primitive cooking, but we did that and I enjoyed it. And when I was in school, I had to cook, and I realized that I was a natural. that I could, my sauces tasted better, my stocks tasted better, my food tasted better because I was passionate about it. And I decided to do my first internship in the kitchen, you know, to pretty much get it out of the way. I still didn't think that this was something I could do because this was a very classed, if you will, society. People didn't think of going to the kitchen. You either thought of becoming a doctor or an engineer or businessman. But being in the hospitality world in the kitchen was not something people thought about. And my first internship was at the Taj Mahal Hotel, the hotel that got burnt a few years ago with the terrorist attack. Mm-hmm. And my first day on the job, they gave me 200 kilos of onions to peel. and they rode me, but I was so happy. I was around food. I got to eat a lot. You know, sit with the cooks in the back in the dishwasher area, and they'd make these wonderful fish curries and biryanis and stuff, and we'd sit down and eat with them. And for me, that was like the best part of this job. I worked like a dog, but the food was so good, and it was so inspiring that I said, you know what, maybe I should do this. So when I finished my course, I decided to go into the kitchen.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So then how did you end up in the U.S.?
After I joined the Taj, I graduated, joined the Taj as a chef's training program, realized, you know, even though I loved what I did, there seemed to be no
future. That's an intercontinental, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. There seemed to be no future for me in India. Mm-hmm. You know, people look down on the job you did. You're a cook. You know, it's like, we have cooks at home. Why would you cook? You know, it was like a very strange thing. So I decided to go to Europe with the intention of leaving India. I went to school in École des Roches in Switzerland. I studied there for a year and a half. And then I decided to immigrate to Australia.
Huh.
Had a little bit of issue with my paperwork. And I was supposed to leave in May, I think, of 87. There was an issue, so it got delayed. My brother's getting married in New York in 87, July. And he asked me to come to the States. He'd been asking me to come when I was in Switzerland.
Mm.
Came here, gave myself 6 months to see if I liked it or not. A day before I was supposed to leave to go back, I got a job and I stayed.
Wow. So you were kind of half-assed looking for a job.
I wasn't really looking because I knew I wanted to go to Australia. America was not a place, the U.S. was not a place that I wanted to be in.
Why?
I don't know, because growing up in India, we were not pro-U.S.
Huh.
You know, things were not, a lot of things about New York was not, all you saw was the things you saw in films.
But isn't that so glamorous? Isn't that the American dream? I mean, Australia has kangaroos.
I know Australia does have kangaroos, but Australia was a country that was accepting chefs at that point. Okay. And it was a mix, you know, of what the U.S. was when all the immigrants came. So there was a lot more opportunity, I thought, in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Little did I know that my best opportunities would be here.
I would say so. So how did you land onto this job?
This current position?
No, not this one. The one that got you to us in New York.
I saw an ad in a paper and I went there and the guy said, let's do a restaurant. You know, why can't you be my chef? And we do this, that, and the other. So I joined them. I changed the menu around. Did a lot of good things. But I wanted to do bigger things. You know, I wanted to work in an American restaurant, if you will, mm-hmm. where I would work with American... It was an Indian restaurant.
Okay.
Work with American ingredients, great technique, learn with a famous chef, if possible. And then I heard about Gray Coons, who opened Les Menas. And my brother knew Gray from the Peninsula Hotel. Introduced me to Gray.
How come your brother... was at the Peninsula?
He worked in the banquets. He was a room service, banquets or room service okay. manager at the Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
And I joined Gray as a salad cook, rose up the ranks to chef de cuisine and left after 6.5 years. While I was at Les Menas, life, you know, you have these stories and interchanging, intertwined things that happen to you that at that point you never know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a cook who had to make a consomme. He's in Atlanta now, and he was failing miserably, and the sous chef was not helping him. And he kept on trying, he kept on breaking the raft, and it was not clarifying. So I said, and I used to do, at the Taj, I used to do consomme 100 gallons a day. So I knew how to make consomme in the back of my hand. So I took Nick, and I showed him how to make a consomme, and he made the consomme, and he was very, very happy that he learned to make the consomme the right way.
Yeah.
Leaves Les Menas, goes and joins Gramercy Tavern.
Wow.
When they're opening... 2 or 3 years down the road in Gramercy Tavern, he hears about Danny Meyer opening, wanting to open an Indian restaurant. He goes to Danny and says, I think you should speak to this guy. If you want to open an Indian restaurant, you got to talk to Floyd because he's the best Indian chef you'll ever find.
Wow.
So Nick Holtash introduced me to Danny Meyer. Then we did Tabla together. Was there for 12 years. Worked with the Union Square Hospitality Group for about 17 years.
Right.
Did the Taqueria with them. Did a lot.
All yeah. Because you helped a guy out with his consommé. That's a tip for everybody out there.
You know, you do the littlest things for people and they remember you. And sometimes we should do it without expecting anything in return. And I never expected anything in return from Nick.
Do you know how I think about it? And this is kind of why I feel like I'm like working 24/7. Is that if I put out like 24/7 hours of like goodness, then like even if two things come back good, then I'm all good.
You know, my dad always said, you know, you can do good in this world, and whatever good you do in this world will always come back to bless you. And if it doesn't bless you, it'll bless your kids. So you know what?
My kids?
Why
can't
not?
Wait that long.
But why not? Why not? You know, I mean, if you do good to expect good, it doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
If you do good without expecting anything, you know, good things happen.
I think it's easier to do good than to, like, to give than to ask, you know? I mean, asking is really hard to do. That's something I had to learn how to do.
Asking is the hardest thing to do.
Yeah.
You know? And it just doing for someone, and my wife does this all the time. She's amazing. The amount she does for people, she's a giver.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to be a giver.
Yeah.
And I think when you give, you get hundredfold.
How did you and your wife meet?
My wife and I went to hospitality school in Bombay.
Okay. Culinary school couple.
No, but this is a great story because we were friends, but we never dated. Because she was Hindu, I was Catholic, and that didn't happen in India.
Oh.
So I go to, we become friends, we leave and we go away, and I go to Switzerland, and she comes to the United States, same time I'm in the United States, and she meets a friend who was my neighbor in Bombay, and connected the two of us.
In New York?
In New York, without us knowing that we were both here. It was very, very strange.
So... Wait, so she met your friend, your neighbor connected, like put you guys on a blind date?
Not on a blind date, just said, I know this guy who went to the same school, maybe you know him.
And then she was like, I do.
Yeah, I do. We were friends when we went to school together.
So when you guys were friends, did you sort of have a crush on each other? Or?
No, we were just good friends.
Wow, so religion could really...
Yeah. I mean, it was not that you were not friends with people out of your religion in India. But marrying out of your religion was not a common thing to do.
It's hard.
It's still not very common in India today. It happens,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't happen that much.
So what religion is your son?
I got two boys.
Two boys.
My wife did an amazing job of raising them Catholic.
Okay.
And baptizing
Is she still Hindu?
She's still Hindu.
Okay.
She took them to Catholic school and First Communion and Confirmation and Baptism and... They went to a private Catholic school.
How'd you guys come to that compromise?
You know, when we got married, the Roman Catholic Church wanted you to make an agreement that your kids would be Catholic, and my wife agreed. And I never forced her,
mm-hmm.
and she just did it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this was a really big summer for you, because you got to take some time off and hang out with your older son?
My younger son. Yeah.
What are their names?
My youngest son is Justin, and mm-hmm. my oldest son is Peter. My oldest son's a senior at the University of Connecticut.
Awesome.
Yeah, and my youngest son is a senior at St. Peter's Prep.
So what'd you guys do?
Oh, I did a lot of really cool things. Firstly, I relaxed a lot. I didn't do anything for close to 4 months.
Nice.
Made a trip with my youngest son to Columbus, Ohio for the National Fencing Meet, which was great. But going to Columbus, Ohio for 10 days was really hard to find interesting food there. so that was hard. Went to Hawaii. I had a friend who lived out in Southampton, Long Island, and stayed with him a couple of days. Took care of my garden, rode my bike, cooked lunch and dinner every day at home for my wife when she wasn't working. woke up in the morning and had coffee with her.
Wow.
You know, things that I never thought I could do. As a chef, you never get a chance to do. You know, but being able to do that every day was pretty cool.
That's fantabulous. So you food styled, food advised the movie 100 Acre Journey.
100 Foot Journey.
100 Foot Journey. I always, why do I can't, that movie, I can't get the name right, even though I went to the premiere and yeah. I love it.
It was really cool because the book is written by a man whose name is Richard Moraes.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Moraes is Portuguese. Yeah. Richard Moraes lived in Bombay. Richard Moraes came to Tabla.
Really?
And Richard Moraes, one of Richard Moraes' editors, was a partner at Tabla. So we had a connection there, and he comes up to me at Tabla one day and says, I have this book that I've written. I'd love you to read it. It's about an Indian chef. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is another book. Someone's writing about an Indian chef, and I started reading the book. And I started finding a lot of parallels in this book about my life. And I love the book. You know, it's like me, a guy from India who wants to come and work here, doesn't get a chance, finally gets a chance, proves to everybody that he can cook, does pretty well for himself, and succeeds. Along the way, he has a lot of things that happen to him, which is very interesting, but it was written very well. And it's about food, and it's about things I love. And when Richard told me that the book was sold to Juliet Blake and Oprah Winfrey, and Steven Spielberg were going to produce a movie, would I be interested in consulting with the food? And I obviously said yes, because I've never done that. I mean, I've done TV and I've done stuff like that. I've written books. So for one reason or another, it didn't work out when they were shooting the movie. So they had to when they were watching dailies at something, I don't know what dailies are, but they said they were watching the dailies and they figured out that this is supposed to be a food film. And the food is not very exciting or interesting. Would I be interested in going to Paris and helping them do three or four dishes? And I said, sure, why not? I'd love to. So I went to Paris, but as we went closer to Paris, the three
is
of
that
one,
where they actually shot it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And in another place in France, I'm not sure where. But the three or four dishes turned out to be 27 dishes. Which was pretty cool, though, to see how it was done and designing things that, because the chef Hassan was an Indian chef who was adapting French food with Indian flavors, something that I used to do. So it was kind of interesting for me to do that and then to go see your name up on the screen in the credits.
And to go to the premiere.
And go to the premiere, too.
I saw you all dressed up. Yeah. I was Google imaging and stalking you.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between creating a dish for, clearly a lot of differences, but most surprising difference between creating dishes for a restaurant menu versus the big screen?
I for me, it was nothing different. It was the same thing.
Interesting.
I'm not a big person to use chemicals in food.
Mm-hmm.
So all the food that I shot was real food. There are tricks on not using salt to pull the moisture out or cooking it just right so it looks nice rather than getting it to a place where it starts dying after some time. Saucing, using sauces that don't have butter, a lot of gelatin in them.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they do, as it sits, they start congealing and start getting ugly. So you don't do that. Not that I use any butter in my food. I mean, I love butter on bread, but I don't cook with it. In White Street, I don't use much butter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd say we use maybe 1 pound of butter for service a night, which is...
Wow.
Which is nothing.
That's unreal.
That's totally unreal, yeah. At Les Penas, we would use a case of butter and cream for lunch and for dinner each. So that's 2 cases of each a day. And we do less covers than we do at White Street.
That is incredible. So you've done like every single dream job for a chef under the sun. You've won Top Chef Masters, right?
Yeah.
And then consulted for a beautiful movie. Like, that movie was adorable, gorgeous, really, 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 really well done. So what's your like other dream job? Like,
oh boy, there is so much I want to do still. I'm working on my second book right now.
Mm-hmm. What's it called?
It's called A Time to Cook. Going to be published next spring. Artisan, excited for that. That's food the way I cook it at home.
Mm-hmm.
So I got that. I got Bombay Canteen. I got White Street. Love to do something more with Indian food. It's not represented enough. It's not made as user friendly as it can be.
Yeah, it's not like cool yet.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. I really don't know. I think for the longest time, people have had this impression that, you know, Indian food has to be over the top spicy and greasy and not recognizable and using ingredients we don't even know. But I think you can, you know, at Tavlan Bread Bar, I did introduce people to those flavors. You know, at White Street, I bring some of those flavors into what I do, but it's not all Indian. And people come sometimes looking for Tavlan, and you don't get Tavlan at White Street.
Mm-hmm.
But you get very flavorful food at White Street. But people, you know, people don't do well-made breads. People don't do well-made vegetables. I think you should adapt the cuisine to what you get in the United States, you know, to the seasonal vegetables that you get. No Indian restaurant does seasonal vegetables. Zero. Not one. I haven't found one that does it. They do the same thing right through the year you'll have cauliflower, right through the year you'll have saag paneer, right through the year you'll have chicken tikka masala. But you won't use meats that are good. You won't use fish that's local. You won't find striped bass from Long Island or fluke from Long Island or scallops from New Jersey or pogies from New Jersey. You know, why can't we do that?
Well, I personally cannot wait to go to your Bombay restaurant. When are you leaving town to go for the grand opening?
I leave Friday night, and we open Tuesday.
Doing a friends and family?
Yeah. Tuesday, Wednesday will be friends and family, and Thursday, Friday will be someone.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming on Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being here.
With just a little bit of time left to wind it down, we've got sommelier Carrie Strong of Ariol, the Charlie Palmer spot in Midtown, on the line after this very quick commercial break.
Was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com. Welcome to the Napa Valley, North America's legendary wine and food capital, where the art of living well is defined and each season holds a story waiting to be discovered. Life feels slower here, lived at a place where tables are set with care. Fine wine and food are created from the bounty of our own vineyards and gardens, and relationships with friends and family gathered around the table are somehow sweeter. When planning a trip to the Napa Valley, we invite you to visit the destination's official visitor website, visitnapavalley.com, or stop by Napa County's official visitor information center, located in downtown Napa, where our friendly and knowledgeable community ambassadors can assist you in creating your own legendary Napa Valley experiences. The Visitor Information Center is located at 600 Main Street in Napa and is open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., 7 days a week, 360 days a year. Your invitation to experience the Napa Valley beckons. Take a deep breath, lose yourself in our quiet green and golden hills, renew your body and spirit, taste our legendary wines and cuisine, and experience the people who make this valley like no other in the world. For more information, go to visitnapavalley.com.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth on Heritage Radio Network. With just a couple minutes left, we're going to wind it down.
Wind down.
With Carrie Strong, sommelier at Ariol. Hello, Carrie.
Hi, Lacey.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's talk events. So, with the decrease of attention span in today's world, for better or worse, we demand quality, we demand fun and excitement. What have you seen that's been working well in consumer wine events and trade wine events?
Well, we show a lot of different events here at Oriol, so we've had to grab people's attentions in ways that we haven't done so before. So, for example, during the holiday, the Halloween holiday, we threw a Krug champagne and a masquerade dinner at Oriol. And we're also doing, coming this season, this spring season, we're doing a Pigs Pinot and Puros. So we're partnering with Nat Sherman and various Pinot Noirs from around the world and serving a pig fest on our outdoor patio.
Fantastic.
And for us on the trade side, you know, we do things like take train trips on historic routes up to Montreal just to grab our attention, because we're really needing that fun and excitement to make sure that the information that we have sticks.
You're talking about the New Zealand wine train trip where you were on a historic train car, an Amtrak train car, and then they just did the lectures on the train and went up to Montreal, and you didn't even really stay for that long.
No, we only stayed for one night, but the bulk of the trip was actually all of the different seminars that we went through on the trip from Penn Station all the way up to Montreal. We got to see all of the Hudson Valley, but we also got to learn, this was for Complexity, which was a New Zealand wine trip, and we got to learn all about the different varietals and nuances of New Zealand wine.
Tell me about the Chicago Wrigley field trip.
Same company we went with for New Zealand wine. It was Complexity as well. They took us up to Chicago, and we got to see a baseball game at Wrigley Field. That was really fantastic. And again, it was based on the wine, but it gave us a different way to look at, or to remember, rather, what we were doing and remember the different wines that we experienced, rather than just sitting down in a classroom setting and trying to memorize all of these wines.
So then perhaps with a trade where, you know, we imagine or we know that, you know, sommeliers are sitting in a classroom very, very hard at work studying. The other way to do it, to make wines more memorable, is to put wine with something else completely unrelated, I guess.
Perhaps. I mean, at Oriol, we have over 1,000 SKUs on our wine list. So we have to know all of the wine in order to sell them. So it behooves the people that are selling the wine to us to give us something a little bit more interesting, relatively the same. And when we're trying to not only sell our wine here from the restaurant, but also when we're trying to put on these wine dinners, we try and make it interesting as well as informative.
And then on the consumer front, you know, you talked about a convergence of consumer and trade, where consumer wine events would typically be, you know, hey, it's fun, you know, and we're drinking. But these days, consumers seem a little bit more open to doing a little bit of learning.
Well, people are more invested in learning about wine, I think, more so than ever. And it's a great time to be in the wine business, just because people want to know the stories and they want to know where the grapes are from, and they want to get our stories as the sommeliers, how we've been to the vineyards and what the interaction that we've had with the winemakers and what their stories are, and we're passing that along to them. So we need to do so in a way that is, as you said, not in a classroom setting, but much more interesting with, you know, out-of-the-box thinking, if you will.
So let me tell you about this one event that I went to that was pretty wild, and I'm still not sure how I feel about it, but it was definitely memorable. So I went to this one thing put on by Côte du Rhône, and we were sitting in this tent thing in the middle of a building in the middle of Manhattan, and then it was like Côte du Rhône for all seasons, and they had dishes paired with wines in a setting where it turned from like snowy to like rainy to, but it was actually snowing inside of the tent. Like we were sitting there
inside the tent.
Yeah, it was like there was almost like a plastic lined pool. I don't want to call it a kiddie pool, but there was a vessel in the middle of this this square shaped table set up where we're all facing each other, almost like at the Model United Nations, like what I used to do in high school. And then there would be like rain, and then we all were delighted, and I'll remember that for the rest of my life.
Right, that's memorable. That's what we have to do. That's how we need to engage our guests, and for all intents and purposes, that's how we need to engage ourselves.
It's like, I don't know, I just Cote d'Rhone. Now my brain, you know, it's filled with this. It's fantastic. And then on my wish list of wine events to do, I don't think he loves this idea, but I've told Thomas Pastachak over at the Nomad a jillion times that he, the classical pianist, by the way, he's a classical pianist, should do a concert where he pairs classical music, and he's going to play that with his big hair and everything and pair it to great Burgundies, or better yet, New York State wines.
The New York State wines would be great. We actually had a harpist, Brandy Younger, was a harpist at the Krug Masquerade event, and everyone loved it. Everyone just absolutely loved the difference of quality in terms of what was going on in the dining room. It wasn't just the wine. It wasn't just the food. There was a lot else going on.
Well, I look forward to the next one, Carrie. Thank you so much for taking a minute.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was just Carrie Strong, sommelier at Charlie Palmer's Ariel Restaurant. Live in studio, we had Chef Floyd Cardoz of White Street and his brand new restaurant in Bombay, India. He's leaving this Friday. At the top of the show, we also heard from Gabe Kennedy, winner of this season of The Taste. We're live 2 p.m. Eastern Wednesdays on Word of Mouth on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Leyte. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.